Hello and welcome to Talking About Tumors with Ryan and Ryan. I'm Ryan Holstead.
And I'm Ryan Quinn.
Today we're going to finish up our discussion around prostate cancer with castrate-resistant metastatic prostate cancer.
Most patients with metastatic prostate cancer will do fairly well on hormonal therapies alone. However, eventually, most people will progress on ADT. If you remember, castration resistance is defined as progression on ADT with a testosterone level less than 50.
Typically, as the PSA can fluctuate from time to time, we like to see two subsequent rising PSAs before defining progression. The term castrate resistance is becoming a bit more of an anachronism as we are incorporating more therapy earlier onto metastatic prostate cancer treatment, as many patients will be on therapies such as abiraterone or enzalutamide or have previously received docetaxel. We may be seeing their progression at a later state after when they would have been resistant to ADT alone.
We generally continue these patients on the ADT even after progression, which may not seem intuitive. However, we do know that gonadotropins are growth factors for prostate cancer, and physiologically it makes sense to continue the ADT while you escalate therapy.
The definition of progression beyond just PSA can be tricky in these patients. Often the majority of the disease is limited to the bones, and our typical RECIST criteria looking for increased size of a soft tissue lesion don't often fit. And there's been guidelines developed by the Prostate Cancer Working Group looking at ways of objectively defining progression. So a PSA rising on multiple measurements is helpful. Objectively, a PSA that's risen 25% from the nadir or the baseline if it didn't respond in the first place, or on imaging seeing two new bony lesions or seeing new bony lesions that are associating with increased pain can help define progression. Sometimes it's important to be patient with the PSA as it can fluctuate, especially in the first 12 weeks of starting a new treatment such as chemotherapy.
All patients with metastatic prostate cancer should undergo germline genetic testing, as they could be found to have a BRCA mutation, which is seen in about 5 to 10% of patients with metastatic prostate cancer, and this would make them eligible for a PARP inhibitor, which we'll speak about later in the discussion.
Historically, prognosis at the time of castrate resistance has been rather short, typically on the range of 1 to 2 years. We've had a significant proliferation of new medications over the past 10 years, and these have given us a lot of options in quick succession. A lot of the understanding of how to sequence these is still emerging. Although we have a fairly clear approach to patients at the time of initial metastatic disease, how to best sequence the medications after they become resistant to the first-line therapy has not yet been finalized. Zoledronic acid or denosumab or other bone-modifying agents do not have a significant benefit in the castrate-sensitive setting. These have shown some improvements in outcomes in patients once they get to the castrate-resistant setting. And at least in one clinical trial, a modest benefit at preventing skeletal-related events, which are defined as pain, fracture, or cord compression. At 2 years, the incorporation of zoledronic acid reduced this from 49% to 38% compared to no bone modifying agent. So this would be something that would be often included in patients with bony disease. It's also important to be mindful of new metastatic lesions and weight-bearing bones, such as the long bones, the femurs, or the humerus. These may require attention, whether that's by your orthopedic surgeon or radiation oncology, to help stabilize the bones prior to initiating further systemic therapy. If patients have not previously received docetaxel at the time of castrate resistance, docetaxel should be considered. Age alone should not be a factor against using docetaxel. It's worth mentioning that in the initial clinical trials where this therapy was approved, patients were up to the age of 92. So these clinical trials have incorporated patients at older ages and have shown feasibility. Of course, the patient in your clinic may not be the patient that would have been enrolled on a clinical trial, so you still have to make your best judgment based upon their functional status rather than their age. Lastly, before we get into the newer agents in the castrate-resistant space, one question, of course, is if I've previously received one of the novel antiandrogen therapies, such as abiraterone or enzalutamide, can I switch to one of its companions? I think it's safe to say that you would not switch from enzalutamide to darolutamide or apalutamide, as these all have the similar mechanism of action. There was one phase 2 trial comparing switching from abiraterone to enzalutamide or enzalutamide to abiraterone and looking at the PSA response rate. This found actually quite a low response rate. However, it did seem more efficacious to switch from abiraterone to enzalutamide than vice versa. In this clinical trial, the objective response rate from abiraterone to enzalutamide was 36%, whereas it was only 4% for the other way around. So this would not be your preferred option, but if a patient is not a candidate for one of the other therapies we're about to discuss, or doesn't have access to it, potentially if they've progressed on abiraterone, you could aim to get maybe a few months of progression-free survival switching to one of the other novel antiandrogens.
The first medication that we'll discuss is called cabazitaxel, which is also a taxane similar to docetaxel, but it does have activity after progression on docetaxel. Cabazitaxel was initially compared to mitoxantrone, which is an older chemotherapy, which is not really used anymore, in the second line setting after progression on docetaxel. This was then studied in the CARD trial, which looked at cabazitaxel in the third line setting after progression on docetaxel, as well as one of the novel anti-androgen therapies, either abiraterone or enzalutamide. And it was compared to the switch that we just spoke about, switching the anti-androgen from abiraterone to enzalutamide or from enzalutamide to abiraterone, which, as we just spoke about, does not have a very good response.
At the time of this trial in 2019, there really weren't any other great options available. So, although essentially a best supportive care control, better than nothing at all.
This did lead to an overall survival benefit, 13.6 months versus 11 months, and did show improvement in pain control. Cabazitaxel does cause myelosuppression, and another notable side effect is diarrhea.
There's a few patients in the clinical trial with lethal toxicities from infections as a result of neutropenia.
Cabazitaxel has also been compared to docetaxel in the first line setting. However, it was not shown to be superior and has its own side effects. So we typically use docetaxel first, followed by cabazitaxel at progression.
The next drug we have to talk about today is radium-223. This is an older drug with its benefit first published in 2013. However, it should remain in rotation. Radium works as a calcium mimetic. It has a similar valence to calcium and emits alpha particles. So theoretically, it would go to the areas of increased bone turnover, such as at the site of osteoblastic or sclerotic bony metastases, releases localized radiation, leading to a response. This was studied in the Elsimpaca trial in 2013. And these are patients who either had prior docetaxel or were not candidates for docetaxel in the castrate-resistant space. This was a randomized 2-to-1 trial from radium-223 or placebo. Once again, there was no other great systemic therapy options at the time, and it was powered for overall survival. This did meet its overall survival endpoint with 15 versus 11 months, hazard ratio of 0.7, did not find a highly significant number of adverse events, and did reduce the risk of developing bony pain. So one limitation of this drug is it only works in the bones, and the patients in this trial were only patients who had bone-only disease.
Yeah, this is a common exam question as well. I'm specifically noting that radium-223 is for bone-only disease. The next medication we're going to speak about is called lutetium-177-PSMA. Similar to radium, this is a radioactive peptide that's attached to PSMA, which is expressed on the surface of prostate cancer cells and will deliver radiation directly to these areas. Of note, PSMA is also expressed in the kidney as well as the salivary glands, which will be important when we talk about the side effects.
This is the same lutetium-177 that is used in our neuroendocrine tumors. However, the targeting molecule is different, and this is a beta-emitting radioactive molecule.
An important thing to note is that not everybody expresses PSMA, so it's important to do a PSMA PET scan prior to therapy to make sure that the patient is eligible for this treatment. In the VISION trial, which studied this, about 86% of patients who were enrolled were eligible, so about 15% did not have PSMA-positive lesions. Now, the VISION trial was a phase 3 trial looking at patients who had previously received docetaxel plus or minus cabazitaxel, as well as at least one novel anti-androgen agent. This was a 2-to-1 randomization versus standard of care. The standard of care was actually fairly limited because, again, as we said, there's not many good treatments after this. Standard of care could not include more chemo, could not include immunotherapy, radium, or another clinical trial. So we're really just looking at GnRH agonists, steroids, switching the anti-androgen, or things like denosumab or bisphosphonates. So the lutetium was given for 4 cycles, 6 weeks apart. There were co-primary endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival. Both endpoints were met. The progression-free survival was 8.7 months versus 3.4 months with a hazard ratio of 0.4. And overall survival was 15.3 months versus 11.3 months with a hazard ratio of 0.62. Side effects of the lutetium It include myelosuppression, renal toxicity, because as we said, PSMA is also expressed in the kidney, salivary gland toxicity, such as pain, dry mouth, swelling. There was also fatigue and nausea.
One of the major criticisms of this trial is that it was open label, and given that the control arm was probably not given the best options, knowing that cabazitaxel would have been available outside of clinical trial, as well as other agents such as olaparib, which we'll get to, there was actually a very high dropout rate in the control arm. And greater than 50% of the patients in the control arm did discontinue the trial upon knowing their randomized allotment. This required an amendment, which was described in the paper as a enhanced educational intervention, where they then went to each individual site to try to explain why the patient should remain on trial. And that did lead to greater patient retention. Kind of an uncommon thing for a clinical trial, and certainly limits our ability to incorporate the evidence, as we do not have a balanced study if half patients left the trial that could have had access to more intensive therapies. Regardless, the fact that there was, you know, at least clear progression-based benefit, I think we can say that this is an active agent and is better than nothing at all at generally well-tolerated toxicity levels. I think whether or not it truly improves overall survival is hard to say based upon this evidence alone, but certainly is an agent to include in your arsenal if you have access to it. Also, an interesting issue right now that maybe by the time you're listening to this will no longer be an issue. These radioactive ligands are only made in a few locations. May only be made in Italy, if I'm correct. And there's been a large delay in order from asking for the drug to getting it in many centers. So if it is something that you think might be needed for your patient, it's good to try to start making arrangements to get access to it sooner rather than later. Hopefully that won't be a permanent issue.
Yeah, definitely. This is a treatment that is not widely available yet. There was also a smaller study, a phase 2 study, looking at lutetium versus cabazitaxel after progression on docetaxel and a novel androgen receptor agent. The primary endpoint of this study was PSA decline greater than 50%. Kind of a strange primary endpoint. However, it was improved with the lutetium, 66% versus 37% in the cabazitaxel arm. However, the overall survival was similar, 19.1 months versus 19.6 months. So because of this, we do have the option of using lutetium either before or after cabazitaxel. I don't think it's really been shown to be better or worse than cabazitaxel.
For a completeless snake, it's worth mentioning sipuleucel-T. This is an FDA-approved agent. This is a cancer vaccine that, unfortunately, due to the way the clinical trial was run, has not really shown benefit and probably should not be part of standard of care at this time. I'll include in our show notes the paper by Dr. Haslam and Dr. Prasad. There's also other commentary on this trial. But essentially, they took patients, they randomized them first line in castrate resistance to either sipuleucel-T or placebo, and upon progression, mandated crossover of the placebo to sipuleucel-T. Both arms had the same time to progression. Progression-free survival was 14.6 weeks, so about 3 months to progression noted on the scan. Median overall survival was improved at 25.8 versus 21.7 months. But the concern that has been raised is that this does not seem to be an active agent, as it did not increase progression compared to control arm, and potentially the control arm being mandated to switch over to the vaccine after progression prior to coming off trial and then switching to an active agent such as docetaxel probably delayed their time to getting effective chemotherapy. So unfortunately a flawed trial, and there's never been a follow-up study done. So still is FDA approved, but doesn't look to be an active agent. And we have much better drugs that have come out since that time.
So next we'll speak about the PARP inhibitors. So as we said, all patients with metastatic prostate cancer should have germline genetic testing to see if they have deficiencies in the homologous recombination repair pathway. It's actually recommended that patients have both germline and somatic testing because there has been shown to be a benefit in PARP inhibitors, even in the somatic mutation setting. You can send tumor samples to certain labs that will do somatic mutation testing. 5 to 10% of patients will be found to have a BRCA1 or 2 mutation and could be eligible for a PARP inhibitor.
When we think about BRCA, if you recall back to our discussions on breast cancer, these do tend to be platinum-sensitive mutations. Interestingly, there have not been any prospective trials looking at platinum agents in prostate cancer. There's some small retrospective studies showing that carboplatin might have an objective response rate of approximately 30%. Some people may consider to incorporate that into their clinical practice for BRCA-positive prostate cancer.
So if you remember the term synthetic lethality from our prior discussions on BRCA, PARP inhibitors block repair of single-strand DNA breaks. And if you have homologous recombination repair deficiencies, then you can't repair double-strand breaks. So eventually, the single-strand breaks will accumulate and will lead to cell death, which is a term that we commonly call synthetic lethality. BRCA2 is more common in prostate cancer than BRCA1, so there's much more data for PARP inhibitors in this setting. However, they are approved for both BRCA1, ATM, and other homologous repair deficiency mutations.
This approval is based upon the PROfound trial. This is a second-line trial. It looks at patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer. They had to progress on at least one line in the castrate-resistant space. Prior taxanes were allowed, but not mandated. And the study was stratified by whether or not patients had previously received taxanes and whether or not they had measurable disease by RECIST criteria. This study had two cohorts. In cohort A, patients had to have a BRCA1 or 2 or ATM mutation, or cohort B included 12 other mutations. ATM was included in cohort A based upon some evidence in the ovarian cancer space, which found that ATM was quite sensitive to these PARP inhibitors, maybe not as much as BRCA1 and 2, but more so than some of the other mutations that we've previously looked at. Patients on the study were randomized 2-to-1, to either olaparib or to physician's choice, which was abiraterone or enzalutamide. The primary endpoint was imaging-based progression-free survival. Secondary endpoints included objective response rate or overall survival. The study screened over 4,000 patients. 2,800 ended up having somatic gene testing, and of those, 30% of the patients had a acceptable mutation to be enrolled in the study. This led to cohort A having 162 versus 83 patients, cohort B having 256 versus 131 patients. 67% of these patients were Gleason 8, 23% had de novo metastatic disease. There were slight imbalances between in cohort A with increased bone-only disease in the olaparib arm with 35 versus 28%, and less visceral disease at 28 versus 39%. And 20% of the patients in cohort A had received previously both abiraterone and enzalutamide. There's a slightly higher number of patients in the olaparib arm that had received docetaxel at 46 versus 39%. The study did meet its primary endpoint of progression-free survival at 7.4 versus 3.6 months. The objective response rate was 33 versus 2%, and median overall survival was 18 versus 15 months. So a positive trial. I forgot to mention that the study did mandate that patients had to have had prior abiraterone or enzalutamide. So once again, the control arm was essentially a placebo control, and that matched with the objective response rate of 2%. Either way, this does seem to be an active agent based upon the study and has since been approved. There did not appear to be an overall survival benefit obtained in the cohort B.
There is a second PARP inhibitor that's approved in this setting called rucaparib. This is approved only for patients with somatic or germline BRCA1 or 2 mutations after treatment with a taxane and at least one anti-androgen therapy. This was studied in a single-arm study, the TRITON2 study, which enrolled patients, again, after a prior taxane and at least one or two prior anti-androgen therapies. The progression-free survival was 9 months, and the response rate was 44%. Of note, they did look at patients with ATM mutations and other mutations such as CDK12 or CHEK2. However, the response rate to these was much less. So that's why it's only approved for BRCA1 or 2.
There have been clinical trials looking at intensifying abiraterone or enzalutamide by incorporating a PARP inhibitor as part of the care. These have shown improvements in progression-free survival, but increased toxicity and have yet to report an overall survival, so would not yet be considered standard of care. So that's our run-through of all the drug options available in the castrate-resistant space. Briefly, we just wanted to go over the situation of PSA recurrence with no further salvage therapy available, as this didn't fit into our prior discussions neatly. So as we had mentioned previously, that if someone's had prior surgery or prior radiation at early recurrence, the first question is whether or not we can salvage this with further definitive therapy, typically with using the alternate localized approach. Occasionally, patients may no longer be candidates for salvage therapy, or they've exhausted all their localized therapy. And when you do see the PSA continue to rise in this case, the first question is there obvious metastatic disease? And not always is there. As we've moved into the PSMA PET era, I think we're doing a better job of detecting the location of metastatic disease sooner. But assuming that there is no obvious radioapparent disease, there have been definitions defined by ASCO stating whether or not their patient is at high or low risk for decompensation, and to help guide whether or not we should start systemic therapy sooner or wait until metastatic disease becomes apparent. The ASCO guidelines defines high-risk disease differently whether or not patients have had prior surgery or prior radiation. If they've had prior surgery, a PSA doubling time of less than 1 year, or a baseline Gleason score greater than or equal to 8 would be considered high risk. If they've previously had radiation therapy, having a PSA recurrence less than 18 months from the time of radiation, or once again having a baseline Gleason score of greater than or equal to 8 would be considered high risk. In low-risk patients, you can consider surveillance. Some patients may prefer to have ADT. In high-risk, ASCO previously had recommended initiating ADT, but more recently have recommended consideration of enzalutamide in ADT based upon a clinical trial that reported out in 2023, which took patients with high-risk criteria. In fact, in this study, they defined high-risk as PSA doubling time at less than 9 months, so a little bit more aggressive than the ASCO definition. And they randomized patients to enzalutamide and ADT, enzalutamide alone, or ADT. And they found that this improved metastasis-free survival at 5 years by 87 versus 71% using enzalutamide and ADT versus ADT alone. And the 5-year overall survival was also improved at 92 versus 87%. In the setting of this trial, patients did stop therapy at week 37 if the PSA remained suppressed less than 0.2 milligrams per deciliter. And if they were to have their PSA start to rise again above 2.5 nanograms per deciliter, they would restart on the enzalutamide and ADT regimen. The study did not use a PSMA PET at baseline, so it's unclear if we may not need to intensify therapy as much at this time, as we might be able to watch a bit more closely with serial PSMA PETs if they're available to you.
Okay, so I think we can get to some bottom lines.
Most patients at the time of diagnosis of metastatic prostate cancer will be receiving more than just ADT alone at this time. They'll be getting ADT and antiandrogen such as abiraterone or enzalutamide, or an antiandrogen, ADT, and docetaxel, depending on how high risk their initial presentation is. This has improved progression-free survival and overall survival. However, most patients with metastatic disease at some point will become castrate resistant and progress.
There are many drugs approved in this setting, the first one being cabazitaxel, which can be used after progression on docetaxel and is superior to just changing the antiandrogen from abiraterone to enzalutamide or vice versa.
If a patient has bone-only disease, you may consider initiating radium-223. And if they have PSMA avid disease, then lutetium 177 PSMA could also be an option available to your patient.
You want to make sure that you're checking for somatic and germline BRCA1 and 2 mutations as well as ATM mutations, because these patients could be eligible for PARP inhibitors such as olaparib or rucaparib.
The FDA has approved the use of olaparib for a whole nother 12 homologous repair deficiencies. It's not overly clear to me how likely these other deficiencies will benefit from the PARP inhibitor on its own.
For patients with bone disease in the castrate-resistant setting, there's a benefit to adding bisphosphonates or denosumab to help prevent skeletal events.
One of the biggest questions will, of course, be sequencing. And when we don't have evidence to support our choice, the best way to do this is to try to sequence your drugs with the least toxicity and have a shared decision-making process with your patient. Some people like the intermittent process of chemotherapy, only coming in every 3 weeks. Others prefer to take a pill once a day.
So that wraps up our prostate cancer discussions, a very important and high-yield topic as we see these patients very frequently.
We're going to move next into bladder cancer and starting off with localized disease and then moving into the metastatic space.
As always, please feel free to leave us feedback on our Gmail account, talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
We're very grateful for those of you who've provided us reviews on iTunes and Spotify. It means a lot to us that people have found this to be a useful resource. To those of you who found this to be a useful resource and have not yet reviewed, please do so. It helps others find the show, and we appreciate it very much.
Thanks for listening, and good luck on the in-training exams. I know that it's that time of year.
Bye for now.
Take care. For more information, follow us on Twitter @TalkingTumors or feel free to email us at talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
Please rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And special shout out to our friend John Kim for all of his musical talents.
And he's the composer of the music that you're hearing right now. Talking About Tumors is not medical advice.
For medical advice, please contact your own healthcare provider.
The opinions stated on this podcast are by the Ryan who said it and no one else. We have no financial disclosures, and this is done purely on our own time to the sake of our enjoyment of the field of medical oncology. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.